for this Thursday, May 28th. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. The unemployment rate in our country continues to surge, with an estimated 41 million Americans out of work, essentially one in four Americans. And it rose by 2.1 million this past week, the number of people who signed up for benefits just in the last 7 days. The president signing an executive order going after social media companies, including Twitter and Facebook. And in campaign 2020, we take a closer look at one state which could determine who wins in November, Wisconsin. The latest on coronavirus and the story shaping Washington Today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with COVID-19, which globally has claimed more than 354,000 lives. Face masks will be the new norm, with guidelines in place across the country. It's a requirement in our region, including Washington, D.C. and in Virginia. Meanwhile, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signing an executive order authorizing businesses to deny entry to those who are not wearing face masks. And the Trump administration announcing an extension through mid-August for those National Guard members involved in the coronavirus response. The White House today also announcing it will not release updated economic projections this summer. That, by the way, is a break from precedent. It comes, as we said just a moment ago, with jobless claims filed by 2.1 million Americans this past week, raising the total to more than 40 million over the past 10 weeks. Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia and his wife, Ann, testing positive for COVID-19 antibodies, making the Virginia Democrat the second member of the Senate to have recovered from the virus. And news from Boston, as Mayor Marty Walsh announces that the Boston Marathon has been canceled this year. It had been pushed from April to September, but the mayor saying, quote, it is not feasible in 2020. So as the U.S. passes a grim milestone, more than 100,000 deaths as a result of this pandemic. This from former Vice President Joe Biden delivering a message on his YouTube page.
My fellow Americans, there are moments in our history so grim, so heartrending, that they're forever fixed in each of our hearts, a shared grief. Today is one of those moments. 100,000 lives have now been lost to this virus here in the United States alone, each one leaving behind a family that will never again be whole. I think I know what you're feeling. You feel like you're being sucked into a black hole in the middle of your chest. It's suffocating. Your heart is broken. There's nothing but a feeling of emptiness right now. For most of you, you weren't able to be there when you lost your beloved family member or best friend. For most of you, you weren't able to be there when they died alone. With the pain, the anger, and the frustration, you'll wonder whether or not you'll ever be able to get anywhere from here. It's made all the worse by knowing that this is a fateful milestone we should have never reached. We could have been avoided. According to a study done by Columbia University, if the administration had acted just 1 week earlier to implement social distancing and do what it had to do, just 1 week sooner, as many as 36,000 of these deaths might have been averted. To all of you who are hurting so badly, I'm so sorry for your loss. I know there's nothing I or anyone else can say or do to dull the sharpness of the pain you feel right now. But I can promise you from experience, the day will come when the memory of your loved one will bring a smile to your lips before it brings a tear to your eyes. My prayer for all of you is that day will come sooner rather than later. But I promise you it will come. And when it does, you know you can make it. God bless each and every one of you and the blessed memory of the one you lost. This nation grieves with you. Take some solace from the fact we all grieve with you.
That's from the former Vice President Joe Biden, who is the presumptive 2020 Democratic nominee. And on Twitter, the president writing the following earlier today. We have just reached a very sad milestone with the coronavirus pandemic deaths reaching 100,000. To all of the families and friends of those who have passed, I want to extend my heartfelt sympathy and love for everything that these great people stood for and represent. And President Trump concluding with, God be with you. At today's White House briefing, in this question to White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany.
Yesterday, the U.S. hit 100,000 deaths from the coronavirus. That happened at around 6 o'clock yesterday evening. It took until about 9 in the morning for the president to recognize that on Twitter. What took him so long?
Look, the president recognized that landmark before we even hit it. The president, that was, after all, it was the impetus behind him lowering the flag to half staff. He did that for several days. And that was an acknowledgement of that number approaching, and he acknowledged it in a tweet this morning.
We hit 100,000 yesterday evening, and it took 13 hours, some odd hours, for him to recognize that and tweet about it.
And far in advance of that benchmark, as I noted, he lowered the flag to half staff. The president has said, you know, you mentioned 100,000, but the president has said one death is too many. He takes this very seriously. He said before this is the hardest part of his presidency. It's something that no one wanted to see happen.
From today's White House briefing, and then there was this moment, this exchange with the White House press secretary.
Shouldn't the president be fact-checked, especially this president who has made so many false and misleading statements that it has put, you know, fact checkers to work across the world? I mean, he's uttered some 18,000 false or misleading statements, according to the Washington Post. If there's any president out there who should be fact checked, any political leader out there should be fact checked, isn't it President Trump? And aren't you trying to silence fact checking by going after Twitter like this?
Look, well, first I would say I disagree with all, if not almost all, of those assertions that you're making there, because, look, if you're going to get into the fact-checking business, there's no one that should be fact-checked more than the mainstream media that has been continually wrong about a number of things. To give you a list of some of the most egregious ones, that ABC News in December of 2017 falsely reported that Flynn would testify that the president directed him during the campaign to make contact with the Russians. That was false. In 2017, your network CNN botched their WikiLeaks email exclusive and were forced to make on-air corrections. CNN's Jim Sciutto, another CNN one, dropped a fictional bombshell in 2018, July, claiming that Michael Cohen would tell federal investigators that the president knew of the Trump Tower meeting. And there are many more, not to just put the onus on CNN there. So if anyone needs to be fact-checked, I think it should be the media.
There are news outlets that make mistakes from time to time. We own up to those mistakes. We correct those
mistakes. Not always. I have many you guys haven't owned up to, I could get to.
We do on a regular basis. The president never owns up to any of his false or misleading statements or outright lies. You have pledged in this briefing room to never lie to the American people. Are you saying that the president of the United States has never lied to the public before?
I'm around the president. His intent is always to give truthful information to the American people. And you mentioned that the media apologizes for their mistruths. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at other headlines in the New York Times saying there aren't enough ventilators to cope with the coronavirus. In fact, we had an excess of ventilators we've shipped around the world. Washington Post, U.S. health system is showing why it's not ready for a coronavirus pandemic. We were ready. There's many more I could get to. I could, on the coronavirus specifically, I could spend the time going through these, but I don't think that's what the American people want to hear.
That from the White House press secretary, and Jim Acosta is the senior White House reporter for CNN. Of course, it was at the White House today that the president did sign that executive order that could potentially open the door for federal regulators to punish Facebook, Google, and Twitter for the way they police content online. The Washington Post describing it, quote, as a major broadside against Silicon Valley that quickly triggered wide-ranging political opposition and threats of a legal challenge. But the president says his action is an attempt to stamp out a political bias on the part of the country's largest social media platforms. He telegraphed this yesterday. He made it official today. More from the Oval Office.
The choices that Twitter makes when it chooses to suppress, edit, blacklist, shadow, ban are editorial decisions, pure and simple. They're editorial decisions. In those moments, Twitter ceases to be a neutral public platform and they become an editor with a viewpoint. And I think we can say that about others also, whether you're looking at Google, whether you're looking at Facebook and perhaps others. One egregious example is when they try to silence views that they disagree with by selectively applying a fact check. What they choose to fact check and what they choose to ignore or even promote is nothing more than a political activism group or political activism. And it's inappropriate. You look at what's happened. You look at where they're going, where they're coming from. I think you all see it yourselves. This censorship and bias is a threat to freedom itself. Imagine if your phone company silenced or edited your conversation. Social media companies have vastly more power and more reach than any phone company in the United States. More reach, actually, than your newspapers, by far. More reach than a lot of your traditional forms of communication. Therefore, today I'm signing an executive order to protect and uphold the free speech and rights of the American people. Currently, social media giants like Twitter receive an unprecedented liability shield based on the theory that they're a neutral platform, which they are not, an editor with a viewpoint. My executive order calls for new regulations under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act to make it that social media companies that engage in censoring or any political conduct will not be able to keep their liability shield. That's a big deal. They have a shield. They can do what they want. They have a shield. They're not going to have that shield.
And that from the president earlier today. He was joined by the Attorney General, Bill Barr, standing behind him. We have posted the full event on our website at cspan.org. On Capitol Hill, the House today voting to request a conference with the Senate over a bill to reauthorize three intelligence programs. This after it failed twice this week to vote on the legislation. The vote in the House 282 to 122, allowing negotiations between the House and the Senate to begin. As Congress tries to reach a deal on legislation to reauthorize programs that have lapsed, while making some changes to the court associated with FISA, which is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. For some background on all of this, we talked to Politico's congressional reporter, Sarah Ferris.
So basically, this has been a vote that has been difficult for both Republicans and Democrats to wrangle for several months. This drama has been going on for a while. We've seen a lot of different positions from President Donald Trump. We've seen for a while there was this fragile coalition of Republicans and Democrats who did want to pass this. They wanted to make some reforms to the federal surveillance powers. They thought it was really important to get some sort of bill across the finish line because right now those powers are lapsed. And of course, it's problematic if you have these, you have an expired federal program. So we saw an effort to try to get this over the finish line this week. If the bill had passed today, it would have gone to the president's desk. We ended up not seeing that happen. There was basically the Republican support completely vanished as soon as President Trump put out a veto threat earlier this week. And of course, you know, you need to house both Republicans and Democrats to be able to carry this bill. There's just too many progressive Democrats who would never support this kind of thing, no matter what kind of pressure they're getting from Democratic leadership. So basically, we saw, you know, they're going back to the drawing table. There's going to be a group of House and Senate Democrats and Republicans who are going to sit down and try to hammer out some sort of a compromise.
The argument from the president specifically is what?
So the president does not want to see Congress intervene in this. He says that there have been abuses against him and his campaign stemming back to 2016. The backstory is a little bit gets into the nitty gritty. There's some conspiracy theories that are kind of wound into this. But basically, the argument is that the president thinks that some of the ongoing investigations with abuses he says have been leveled against him need to be fully baked. These investigations need to be carried out before he can advocate what kind of reforms he wants Congress to take on. And there are a good amount of Republicans who are backing him on this. And we saw virtually all support within the Republican Party disappear as soon as the president staked out this latest position. But we have to remember this bill that the House was going to take up, this is a bill that already passed in the Senate with broad bipartisan support. There were a majority of Republicans supporting this bill. And in fact, the House passed a very similar bill to this in March, again, with a majority of Republican support. So it just shows how much Trump's opinion, which has wavered on this, his position really has changed, just going back and forth. And his latest position was the one that ultimately killed this effort and forced both parties to have to start again on their negotiations.
We're talking with Sarah Ferris. She covers Congress for Politico, the House in for a couple of days this week as we move into June. What does the calendar look like?
Right. So the calendar has changed a lot in the House. Of course, we did see the Senate come back last month. They've tried to maintain more of a regular schedule. The House, which has four times as many members, has had to be really careful about when it comes back. They've only been in for a limited number of times since March. And we just saw House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer announce to members this afternoon on the floor that there will not be votes next week. He doesn't know yet when members will be asked to return, but everyone will be given 72 hours notice because, of course, it takes a good amount of effort for members to come back to Washington, finding flights and some of them driving across the country. So there really is a time crunch, though, because there's a lot of the to-do list for the House is extremely long going into the August recess. Normally, this would be the time when lawmakers of both parties are really at the table working on appropriations bills. There's a Pentagon policy bill that needs to be done rather quickly. There's a lot of bills that are not annual bills, but are coming up every so often. They happen to be due this year. That includes a very big highways bill. There's a water resources bill. And so these are all bills that Mr. Hoyer said on the floor today. They are beginning work on that. They will start at the committee level. And as soon as they're ready to bring to the floor, they're going to be having members come back. And the goal is to have as many of these important votes happen at one time to minimize the amount of flying and driving that each member has to do before they come back to Washington.
And so is it your sense that this will likely be the new norm into the summer with Congress here for a couple of days and then off in light of the pandemic?
I think there's about as much uncertainty in the congressional calendar and in the congressional procedure than that there is in the everyday life of all Americans. I think, if D.C. is still a hotspot right now, there is some effort to reopen part of the city. But I think, obviously, it's difficult in Congress when you have members coming from all over. There's always going to be members coming from parts of the country that are facing, outbreaks that are more acute than in other places. So both Democrats and Republicans running the House will have to be taking all this into account. Of course, the proxy voting system got up and running this week. We saw roughly 70 members taking advantage of that system. That meant that lawmakers were able to choose a proxy to vote on their behalf while they did not have to travel to the House chamber. And many of those were older members or those who had underlying health conditions or who lived across the country that would have required multiple flights. And so the House now has a system to be able to function even when the full House cannot meet for regular business.
More details at Politico.com. Sarah Ferris, who covers Congress, as always, we thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And so with that background, Democratic leadership today blaming the failure to secure passage of that reauthorization bill squarely on President Trump. Speaker Nancy Pelosi, she spoke to reporters earlier today during her regular Thursday news conference.
Again today on the floor, we are not going to be taking up the bill that was sent over by the Senate, the FISA bill. Yesterday in the morning, the Republican on the Committee of Jurisdiction, one of the committees of jurisdiction, Judiciary, Mr. Jordan, testified in favor of the bill. Sometime after that, the president said he would veto the bill. So all of the Republicans then abandoned their commitment to security and said that they were going to vote against the bill. This has always been bipartisan. Mr. Jordan said in the committee yesterday, "I would like to thank Senators Lee and Leahy for their amendment to the House-passed bill, which strengthened the amicus role in these proceedings by extending them to any sensitive investigative matter involving U.S. persons." This was in his testimony in support of the bill yesterday until the president spoke, and then all of a sudden the commitment to national security disappeared by a tweet, twinkle of a tweet, as they say, disappeared. So this has always been bipartisan, and I don't have any intention of departing from the fact that on FISA bills, we are always going to have to go in a bipartisan way. And if the Republicans were abandoning their commitment to that because of the president, that means we could not override his veto. So he didn't want to subject everyone to something that was not consistent with what we did just about 2.5 months ago when we passed a bipartisan bill. Two-thirds of the Democrats, two-thirds of the Republicans voted for the legislation overwhelmingly, veto-proof, sent it to the Senate. The Senate sent back a bill with 80 senators voting for it, 45 Republicans. 45 Republicans voted for that strengthened FISA bill, strengthening the protections for American people in it. and then the president said he would veto it. But it's no surprise because the administration, especially those in the Justice Department, really don't want any bill that provides protections for the American people. They want to have all the leeway in the world to do what they do. It's most unfortunate. But we will hopefully go to a conference so that we can represent and debate all of the views in our caucus and their caucuses, the Republican caucus, Democratic caucuses, to come up with a bipartisan legislation, because I do believe we need a bill in order to protect our security and our liberty. Security and liberty, always the balance that we have.
That from the House Speaker, and again, FISA is an acronym for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Congress basically punting on any passage of that bill until sometime later this summer. And as we pointed out, when the FISA bill was before Congress back in March, there was House Republican support. That has changed in the last 48 hours. Here's GOP leader Kevin McCarthy of California.
Mr. Leader, the Speaker this morning on FISA criticized you and your Republican colleagues for basically doing a 180 on the FISA vote because the president sent a tweet. Wonder if you wanted to respond to that. And second, what is the path forward on this bill? Previously, many Republicans have said these are very crucial national security authorities that need to be there for national security reasons. Do we have to wait for the outcome of the Durham investigation to move forward? What possibly is the path forward here?
The path forward is exactly what I told Majority Leader Steny Hoyer just a couple days ago. I would take a pause because every single day we learn something new. Remember what FISA is from Foreign Intelligence Surveillance. But it was used for surveillance on Americans. And every day we learn something more. Shouldn't we take an opportunity to correct that? Lo and behold, the Speaker is now coming to the same position I told him would probably be best a couple days ago. Maybe she's upset by that, but I think that's the appropriate thing to do. Why don't we get back together, work with the administration, find out any more unmaskings from a past administration of how they misused this FISA and others, and correct it so no American could go through this again. Interesting to me that the former vice president now running for president unmasked people. Ambassadors that were appointed by President Obama were unmasking people. Then look at the time frame of when it was done. After the election. After someone's duly elected become president, in a time frame of a lame duck presidency, from the beginning of January to being sworn in mid-January. Very interesting. While at the same time, they know from their own individuals all what they are professing to the American public about Russia was not true. Yeah, there are some grave concerns here, and they should be fixed.
Those comments earlier today by the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy of California. On our podcast, The Weekly, we talked to Congressman Derry Kilmer. He is the Washington Democrat who is the chair of the House Select Committee on Modernizing Congress. Among his recommendations, and is a bipartisan list of recommendations, fixing the budget process in the House to streamline committee hearings and pass a spending plan on time. Here's part of that conversation from earlier today.
Some of the greatest challenges that we've seen that have the greatest impact on the American people are the dysfunction within the budget process and the number of times in recent years where you've seen government shutdowns or continuing resolutions where Congress, in essence, kicks the can on spending decisions. And it creates great uncertainty for federal agencies. It creates great uncertainty for our constituents. You look at a district like mine, the largest employer in my district is the federal government. It's the Navy, but we also have a massive veterans population. So, you know, when the VA, when there's a government shutdown and, you know, the VA operations are disrupted, or when the national park closed for several weeks, that doesn't just affect the federal workforce. That has substantial impacts on private industry as well, our local hotels and restaurants and things like that, that obviously right now are really suffering as a result of the coronavirus as well. So we as a committee have had a lot of discussions related to budget and appropriations process reform.
Join us for more of our conversation with Congressman Derry Kilmer on our podcast, The Weekly. It's available on the free C-SPAN Radio app, or better yet, on the web at cspan.org/podcasts. On Wall Street, the Dow lost nearly 148 points. The NASDAQ was down 43 and the S&P off by 6.5. News on China did rattle the markets today, in part because China is advancing a law that would effectively nullify Hong Kong's semi-autonomous status, a move that could endanger its special status as a financial hub. The Secretary of State Mike Pompeo today reporting to Congress that Hong Kong was no longer autonomous from China, potentially opening the door to a legal change in how America deals with Hong Kong in terms of trade and travel. And we'll hear more from the president tomorrow on China, including more blame for its early response or lack thereof on coronavirus. TheHill.com reporting that the president previously said that he was mulling withdrawing from a January trade deal that scaled back some tariffs between the two countries, and that, too, may be on the table. Also today, in Minneapolis, city leaders trying to reassure the public after 2 days of violence, which turned into some destructive fires overnight. It, of course, following the death of 46-year-old George Floyd. The video of a white police officer holding his knee on his neck as he gasped for air continues to shock the city and the country. Meanwhile, the Justice Department and the FBI have pledged to undertake what they're calling a robust criminal investigation into the death of George Floyd, calling it a top priority. His family seeking an independent autopsy of the body because it doesn't trust Minneapolis city officials. And the owner of the store near the site of that altercation over the Memorial Day weekend saying that he called the police to report that George Floyd had allegedly passed off a counterfeit $20 bill, adding he saw no signs that Floyd had resisted any type of arrest. We're beginning with a series of conversations with reporters from key battleground states in campaign 2020, and this evening we focus on Wisconsin. A reminder, you're listening to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio.
As we look at the key battleground states in campaign 2020, we're joined here in Washington with Craig Gilbert. He is the bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And as you look at COVID-19 and the political climate across Wisconsin, what is the state of play right now?
Well, Wisconsin's a very almost perfectly divided state along kind of red and blue lines. It also has a divided government right now with Republicans, large majorities in the legislature, but a Democratic governor. So there's been a lot of kind of growing partisan disagreement and conflict over how to manage the pandemic between the governor and the legislature. And Wisconsin, you know, is a little bit unique in that we had this situation where a state Supreme Court with a conservative majority struck down the governor's stay-at-home order. So overnight lifting the restrictions that had been put in place and which were gradually going to be lifted anyway. So that's kind of the state of play in Wisconsin. Wisconsin's also had two elections in the middle of the pandemic, which of course have attracted a lot of national attention.
And I want to focus on campaign 2020, but let's go back 4 years to 2016 with the results between then-candidate Donald Trump and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And again, we are reminded just how close the race was between the two contenders, less than one percentage point between the two of them. What were the mistakes that the Democrats made, and what did the Trump campaign do right in 2016?
Well, I think it had more to do with what the Democrats did wrong. They neglected the state. They took it for granted. They thought that they had the upper hand politically when they didn't. And, you know, it wasn't strange that Wisconsin had a close election because we had very close elections in 2000 and 2004. But the forces that went into that election were very odd. I mean, you had massive swings in rural areas. You had kind of Trump underperforming some Republican suburban areas. So, you know, I don't second guess the campaigns for being surprised by the outcome, but I think you do have to second guess the Democrats in particular for not mounting a serious campaign in Wisconsin.
It was a state in the Democratic primary that Bernie Sanders won over Hillary Clinton, but the opposite in 2020, when the primary was held in early April after the start of this pandemic, an easy victory for the Joe Biden campaign. What do you attribute that to?
I think on paper, this could have been a good state for Bernie Sanders. You pointed to his win in 2016, Wisconsin. You know, there's a big progressive, you know, element within the Democratic Party in Wisconsin. But by the time the Wisconsin presidential primary came around in early April, you know, the national picture had just entirely flipped with Joe Biden sort of taking command of the race and Democratic voters across the country kind of deciding that he's going to be the nominee. So we had presidential primary in Wisconsin that coincided with a big April nonpartisan state election. And by the end, the state election ended up commanding a lot more attention within the state than the Democratic presidential primary did.
As you look at the campaign with both President Trump traveling to the state on a couple of occasions and also a lot of effort by the Democrats with the party convention in Milwaukee now in mid-August, what are you seeing on the ground?
Well, we've had Joe Biden do some virtual events in Wisconsin. Earlier on, you know, we had President Trump visiting Wisconsin. You know, this is a big question mark, like it is in a lot of places going forward, and particularly in the case of the Democratic convention, which has already been pushed back from a July convention in Milwaukee to an August convention in Milwaukee the week before the Republican convention in Charlotte. But Republicans, of course, have been much more openly flirting with the idea of a virtual convention than, I mean, Democrats have compared to Republicans. So we don't know how much of a physical convention there's going to be in Milwaukee. We think it's going to be, at a minimum, a largely heavily virtual convention, but we don't know if it's going to be entirely remote, mostly remote, or a little bit of both.
So based on that, it is clear why the Democrats chose Milwaukee as their convention city, but will they get any traction as you look at this in late May?
Yeah, so it's hard to know how much of a payoff they're going to get from the convention itself. I mean, part of the value of having a convention is, for example, sort of building a volunteer army around the convention. And it's hard to do that if it's not a traditional convention attracting thousands and thousands of delegates and others to Milwaukee. It's also, you know, the symbolism, the symbolic value of having a convention in Milwaukee, a city where Democrats underperformed, and Wisconsin, a state that they, you know, obviously let slip through their hands in 2016, Midwest industrial battleground. The symbolic value of that is probably not as great if you don't have a traditional physical convention in Milwaukee and if it's a mostly remote event. So big questions there, but we also know that Democrats aren't going to repeat the mistakes of 2016 when they neglected the state. I mean, they are going to fight for their lives in Wisconsin in 2020.
So as you look at the Democratic and Republican strongholds in the state, clearly Milwaukee, Madison, strong for the Democrats, perhaps Green Bay and Racine, strong for the Republicans. Where else are you looking?
Well, the thing about Wisconsin is that it doesn't fit all the stereotypes we have nationally of sort of what kinds of voters are Republicans and what kinds of voters are Democrats. I mean, we have, you know, educated, college-educated, well-to-do suburbs around Milwaukee that in another state, in a national context, you might think of as being Democratic-leaning, but are Republican-leaning in Wisconsin. We've also had a history of rural white communities in Wisconsin that are divided between red ones and blue ones. So part of the drama and part of the suspense in Wisconsin is whether some of these voters are going to sort of go back to form in Wisconsin, and whether some of the rural Democrats are going to swing back to the Democrats after voting for Trump in 2016, and whether some of the suburban Republicans are going to perform better for Trump after not performing very well for him and Republicans in recent cycles. So that's a big part of the drama in Wisconsin.
And of course, over the years, a big part of campaign has been the grassroots effort, knocking on doors, making telephone calls. This is going to be a very different kind of campaign with COVID-19. So how do the parties adapt to these changes?
So they're already adapting. I mentioned we've already had two elections in Wisconsin in the pandemic. We had our April election, which wasn't, again, just the presidential primaries, but was a big major judicial election, which basically had, you know, was almost a partisan election in reality. And we also had a congressional election in northern Wisconsin. So one thing that's happened is the state has kind of overnight on the fly converted to heavily mail voting, absentee ballots by mail, which had very little precedent in Wisconsin before this election. So the parties are already kind of adjusting to the notion that a huge amount of their vote will be cast via absentee mail ballots, and they're organizing around that. There are political controversies around that, and they're just having to kind of shift their operations to sort of digital organizing from kind of face-to-face organizing.
So if you could give us a snapshot, the state of the Trump campaign right now and the state of the Biden campaign in Wisconsin.
So I've been looking at all the polling in 2020. If you take, the most reliable pollster in Wisconsin is the Marquette Law School poll, and they've polled four times in 2020. And if you combine all those numbers, Joe Biden is about 2.5 points ahead of Donald Trump, which is smaller than Biden's lead in the national poll. So that tells you how competitive the state is. And if you look at perceptions of President Trump, it's basically 50-50, 48% approval, 49% disapproval. The state itself is perfectly divided between Republican voters and Democratic voters. So it has all the ingredients of a kind of down to the wire state, assuming this is a close national election, and each party has its particular challenges. Democrats need to do a better job of getting out the vote in Milwaukee, and they need to try to win back some of those purple rural communities that swung to Trump. And Trump's big challenge in many ways is shoring up the Republican vote in the suburbs. Obviously a weakness nationally, and in the last two election cycles, a weakness in Wisconsin.
And clearly one of the big lessons of campaign 2020 is don't pay attention to the national polls. It will come down to the state polls in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, and elsewhere.
Yeah, and the state polling, one of the remarkable things about the state polling in Wisconsin is how little the numbers change from month to month. If you think of all the things that have happened in recent months, we've had impeachment, we've had a pandemic, we've had a massive economic crisis. Month by month, these numbers just don't change very much. Joe Biden's a little bit ahead of Donald Trump. His approval rating is invariably in the high 40s. In fact, in the last six or seven polls, his approval rating has been 47 or 48%, talking about President Trump, in every one of those polls. So that tells you kind of how stable the race is in many respects. And that's, again, a kind of a formula for a very competitive and maybe somewhat unpredictable November.
And just as a quick aside, does that surprise you?
Well, it from one perspective, it does, just given the volatility of the real world. From another perspective, no. In the sense that, we've seen how polarized Wisconsin is, how dug in people are, kind of in their partisan tribes. Wisconsin is probably as good an example of that as any state in the country. And so when you have basically each party's voters overwhelmingly supporting their party's candidate, they both appear to be kind of equally enthusiastic about the election at this point. These voting blocks are the same size. So there's not a lot of play in the numbers. There is a small band of, independent, uncommitted voters. And one of the things that was decisive in 2016 was the voters that disliked both candidates swung to Donald Trump. Whether they will vote the same way again in 2020 is a huge question.
On Battleground State, Wisconsin, Craig Gilbert, he is the bureau chief here in Washington for the Journal Sentinel in Milwaukee. We thank you for being with us.
Great to be with you.
And more of our conversations with key reporters in those states that will determine the winner and loser in campaign 2020. And you can follow it all on our website at cspan.org. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, is also available as a podcast on our website, cspan.org/podcasts. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. I'm Steve Scully in our nation's capital. Enjoy the rest of your evening.